Welcome to the program. Noel Debien standing in for Andrew West. This week, the world has been focused on Melbourne as George Cardinal Pell appeared in court, there with his legal team for the first time to address multiple charges of historical sexual offences. He's the highest ranking official of the 1.2 billion member Catholic Church to defend himself in a criminal case in nearly 70 years. This time, it's not an atheistic communist show trial charging a Catholic leader with treason, as happened to Hungarian Cardinal Joseph Mitzenti back in 1949. It's a criminal trial in a free and secular liberal democracy. Andrew West was among the early risers this morning at the Melbourne Magistrates Court, and he joins us now.
I certainly wasn't among the earliest of birds arriving at the court. A CNN crew was there at 5 o'clock this morning. I got there pretty early. I can't say that it was a circus, but it certainly was a media throng, the likes of which you're not likely to see most days outside the Melbourne Magistrates Court. But what struck me, Noel, was the very fact that you had international media there, especially CNN, also the BBC. It really does bring home the sort of tremendous historic import of this occasion. The first time such a high-ranking church official, a cardinal, number three in the hierarchy, has been facing these criminal charges, and that's anywhere, as far as we know, in the world. Even though, of course, the whole hearing lasted for less than 10 minutes.
I remember Bishop Geoffrey Robinson, who wrote Confronting Sex Power in the Catholic Church, said that any investigation, any self-analysis of the church has to go to the top. And in a sense, the media presence you've described shows that there really is international interest in this.
Yeah, I mean, you'll recall, Noel, and you yourself spoke with the BBC. I've spoken with the BBC in the past. Because the Vatican itself has been forced to take this seriously, Cardinal Pell, I should say today, and his lead attorney, Robert Richter, QC, one of the leading QCs in Australia, emphasised that he will plead not guilty on all of the offences, that he will vigorously defend the charges, that he will not waver at all from the position that he has consistently taken, not simply since these charges were announced a few weeks ago, but that he's taken for months and even years when allegations first arose. So he's going to maintain, on all accounts, a not guilty plea and vigorously defend himself.
As I understand it, from the nature of the proceedings this morning, the Cardinal did not need to enter a plea, but his legal team did enter a plea. Now, that has some significance, I think, in terms of the huge public profile surrounding this case.
Yes, as I understand it, he wasn't even required to be in the court himself. But I think, Noel, this goes to Cardinal Pell's repeated and very strong assertions of his innocence. And therefore, it was decided that get this out there as early as possible and be there in the court, even though you're not required to be there in person. Normally, your legal representatives can take care of this. But I think this is Cardinal Pell really reinforcing the message he gave in Rome that he wants his day in court. Well, this was his first day in court, and even on such a minor procedural matter, he wanted to be there.
What was the tone of the crowd? We saw some presence of protesters as well.
Yeah, it should be pointed out, Noel, there were people there who were in support of Cardinal Pell, as well as people who were part of the crowd demanding accountability from the church. The anti-Pell protesters weren't so much anti-Pell personally. They were people who've kept up the drumbeat of protest on questions of accountability. There was one man saying that churches and schools and all institutions need to be reminded of their duty of accountability, their duty of care. There was also a small number of people there who were in support of Cardinal Pell. There was one lady who held a sign saying, "Thank you for the help that you've given my family." So there were people who were in support of him as well. But generally, the biggest crowds were, of course, the international media.
Was there any special treatment given to Cardinal Pell?
Well, not on the face of it. There was probably a dozen police surrounding Cardinal Pell as he went in. I suspect any high-profile person who was facing the magistrate's court would have also been afforded that level of protection. But inside the magistrate's court, Noel, it was pretty much business as usual. It was a very brief and sort of orderly appearance. He sat with his legal defence team, with Robert Richter. Interestingly, Paul Galbally, who is from a pretty distinguished Melbourne legal family, is now part of George Pell's legal team. But there appeared to be no special privileges, no special conditions granted to Cardinal Pell. The only thing is, it was pointed out that the walk that he took from his lawyer's office in Lonsdale Street around to the court in William Street probably took longer than the court hearing itself, simply by virtue of the Cardinal being shadowed by such a deep throng of media. It was probably three or four deep at times.
Andrew West on the ground in Melbourne, thanks for reporting in.
Always a pleasure, Noel.
Andrew West in Melbourne at the tail end of a brief holiday, catching some of the action at the Melbourne Magistrates Court. Now, to give a clearer picture of why today is so historically important, I'm joined by Barney Schwartz. Barney is former religion editor at the Melbourne Age, now a senior fellow at the Centre for Public Christianity. Barney, remind us of some of the markers in the career of Cardinal George Pell.
George Pell was the first Australian to be on the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the theological watchdog for the Vatican.
Formerly known as the Inquisition in ancient times.
Indeed. But he got to know the head of the congregation, later Pope Benedict XVI, who was Joseph Ratzinger, and he was a powerful and influential friend.
So we're talking about a direct line to the man who became Pope. There was a personal relationship already established.
That's correct, and I believe that Cardinal Pell was also on the radar of the previous Pope, John Paul II, because he was exactly the sort of strong, muscular, determined, orthodox, authoritarian Catholic that John Paul II was himself.
That, of course, meant that Pope Benedict was willing to come to Australia in 2008 with 400,000 pilgrims, I think.
Yes, World Youth Day was one of the biggest events that Australia's ever held. It was at Randwick, 400,000 gathered in one spot. I believe that might be the biggest assembly that Australia's had, certainly more than Billy Graham got at the MCG, which is not quite as big.
Not only was he on the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, but Cardinal Pell was on the Congregation for Bishops, which meant he could influence the placing of bishops throughout the entire world, and that he could influence the nature of those bishops, and was likely, and I would expect, he would appoint like-minded bishops where he could.
I think there's no doubt about that. Highly capable, quite determined in following through any agendas, and very skilled at surrounding himself with competent people who will carry out his will.
Then he ends up as part of the group of eight, which is now nine, cardinals chosen to advise Pope Francis.
Indeed. I've often wondered if that was purely geographic, or if it was because Pope Francis really particularly valued George Pell's insights, because, of course, they are quite different in style and in demeanour.
And then Cardinal Pell becomes head of Vatican finance. What's the significance of that role?
The very qualities that got George Pell to become a cardinal, those qualities of drive and determination and the combative, pugnacious personality that refused to be beaten, that was exactly what Pope Francis was looking for in somebody to tackle the Curia, which is notoriously difficult, labyrinthine, highly political, vast numbers of separate interests going their own ways. Pope Francis wanted somebody from outside, as it were, who could come in and, if I can mix my classical allusions, clean the Augean stables, which George Pell started doing very well.
Drain the swamp, I think, is the American term.
That's probably more appropriate, Noel, than what was in the stables.
I also want to ask you about education, expanding and establishing Notre Dame as the second Catholic university in Sydney as well. How does that figure in what's happened within the Australian church and picture?
George Pell has always been big on education. He had a fine education himself at Rome and then getting a doctorate at Oxford, and he's always taken education very seriously. They already had the Australian Catholic University in Sydney, of course, and he felt that they needed more, and he single-handedly, as it were, brought about Notre Dame. It was, again, a fine accomplishment.
And included in Notre Dame, he established Australia's first Catholic medical faculty. Now, Cardinal Pell was also in charge of the Vox Clara committee that oversaw the retranslation of the Roman Missal into English. Now, that affected millions of Catholics who speak English right throughout the world.
Yes, and it was highly unpopular because he seemed to favour a much more archaic and unwieldy version of the language, seeming to think that this was all reverent. And on this side of Vatican II, people wanted much more flexibility and much more vernacular style of language. But as so often, Cardinal Pell's view prevailed.
When it comes down to it, though, it's not only about this extraordinary leader with strength and drive who has really gone almost to the top. If the Pope died, he could be elected Pope. It's entirely possible. But you've also mentioned the other side of Cardinal Pell, that he was determined to crush dissent in the Church. What are some examples of what you mean?
Talk to any of the priests who were at seminary with him. Most of them were progressive. They had entered the Church around the time of Vatican II. They'd come in with hope of reform and a new openness. And George Pell, as this auxiliary bishop and then archbishop, did not agree with that, and he crushed dissent. He ended careers, he moved people, he cleaned out, as he would put it, the seminary in Melbourne. He just ensured that dissent was not allowed to flourish. For George Pell, it was my way or the highway, although, of course, he would say that my way was the Orthodox Catholic way. Nevertheless, he wasn't willing to entertain other views of what the Orthodox Catholic way might be.
He was not ever elected head of the Bishops' Conference, which is surprising given he was cardinal.
Yes, and priests have told me that is because many of the bishops were drawn from the same mentality as the priests themselves. They were far more open. They resented what they saw as his arrogance and his bullying, and they felt that he took too much upon himself. Although Australia's leading Catholic, he was still only the Archbishop of Sydney, and he had no right to tell them how to run their diocese. And they were not willing to give him more power.
He's also favoured groups such as Opus Dei.
Yes, and the Neo-Catechumenate. He certainly has. That is, because in these groups, there is great devotion to the high conservative and authoritarian nature of the Church. Don't forget that Cardinal Pell attracted attention a few years ago for writing about conscience. He felt that conscience, although important, was definitely subservient to the teachings of the Church, and therefore freedom of conscience was not a luxury that he fully endorsed.
I recall him saying that he thought the doctrine of the primacy of conscience should be quietly dropped, I think was the quote he said in the Acton lecture he gave.
Well remembered, Noel, you're quite right.
Now, the Cardinal is also known for saying publicly that politicians, Catholic politicians, who supported abortion or freer abortion should not receive communion.
Yes, and that's another example of where he's not willing to allow people their own consciences, it seems to me. But I suppose the Cardinal says, well, it's the teaching of the Church and that's all there is to it. I suppose that having gone on about freedom of conscience as I've done in the last few minutes, I should say that George Pell, like him or loathe him, was always true to his conscience on these doctrinal matters. There was a real integrity to some of his positions, whether I agree with them or not, given that they were unpopular in society and that he was undeterred by that and he just spoke out for them. He was not willing to bow to the winds of moral relativism, as Benedict called it.
Barney Schwartz, can I ask you about the uniquely Melbourne response to clerical and sexual abuse? How factual is it to say he was the first Australian bishop to take action?
Well, it is accurate to say he was the first to actually introduce something. He wasn't the first to take action because the Bishops' Conference had been working for many years on the national protocol called Towards Healing. And so when he became the first, he caused outrage and fury among the other bishops because he ended the prospect of a truly national response. To this day, Toward Healing applies in every diocese except Melbourne. He said he did it because he wanted to help the victims, and I do not doubt that that was part of the motivation. But there seem, as is so often the case in human affairs, there were other motives as well. And I think more importantly was protecting the institutional Church. For example, he capped payments at $50,000 that later rose to $75,000, whereas Towards Healing has no cap. To his credit and to the credit of the people he employed to set it up, it did give redress to a lot of people who had no other chance. For example, if the priest who abused them had died, there would have been no recourse through the courts. But now there was some possibility of action.
Now, remind us of the so-called Ellis defence and its significance in the public mind.
John Ellis was abused in Sydney as a boy, and he tried to sue the Church. If I have this aright, he sued the property trust as the entity which had the money and therefore could provide compensation. However, the defence was that that had nothing to do with the abuse, and in fact there was no entity that could be sued. And so the Ellis defence became a precedent by which it became apparent that the Catholic Church could not be sued in court for compensation as there was nobody who could be sued. When the Royal Commission investigated this, it was clearly appalled by the Ellis defence and has taken steps to end that, and the Catholic Church is complying, as it has done pretty much with all the demands of the Royal Commission.
Now, Cardinal Pell is sometimes portrayed in media as humourless. Now, that's not a man I know, I've got to say. I do recall even at his first, I think, media conference when he became Archbishop of Sydney, one journalist asked him the predictable question, and what do you think of the Sydney gay and lesbian Mardi Gras? And the Cardinal's response was, oh, we won't be sending a float this year.
Yes, he certainly has a dry sense of humour. When he's relaxed, he can be very convivial, I'm told.
The Cardinal has returned voluntarily to Australia. The court has begun proceedings. What do you take from his voluntary return? He took leave, the Pope gave him leave. What significance do you see in that?
It's very evident that he is determined to fight these charges. He did not come back for the last hearing of the Royal Commission and got enormous criticism for that. He has come back paying due attention to his health by taking several days with lots of stops. But he is here. I think he could do no less, and I think he would want to do no other. The difficult times for him undoubtedly lie ahead.
Barney Schwartz, a former religion editor of the Melbourne Age and now a senior fellow of the Centre for Public Christianity. You're with the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Noel Debien, sitting in for Andrew West. It's just over 2 months since Salman Abedie blew himself up at an Ariana Grande concert in the UK's northern city of Manchester. He took 22 young lives with him and injured 116 people. As Manchester tries to come to terms with the bombing, there's a conversation going on about how to tackle extremist violence. Hamish McDonald has been looking at the Manchester bombing for ABC TV's foreign correspondent, but in this special report for us, he looks at the impact of the bombing on the lives of three Muslim women in Manchester.
I'm in the northern British city of Manchester. It's a remarkable place. Home to the biggest football club in the world, Manchester United. This place is famous for music, Joy Division, The Smiths, Oasis. They all came from here. The Industrial Revolution started here. This is a tight, proud, and diverse city. While Muslims make up 5% of the British population, 16% of the population in Manchester is Muslim. Over the years, Manchester has welcomed people from all over the world, including one Libyan couple fleeing the Gaddafi regime. Their 22-year-old son, Salman Abedie, was born here.
Police get bound! Police get bound this week!
At 10:31 p.m. on Monday the 22nd of May this year, Salman Abedie detonated a suicide bomb at the Manchester Arena. His target? The young, the hopeful, the innocent. They'd been attending a concert by the American pop singer Ariana Grande. 22 people died, 116 were injured.
We have been treating this as a terrorist incident. And we believe at this stage, the attack last night was conducted by one man.
Manchester isn't a big city. Around 500,000 people live here. Everyone seems to know someone who was there that night. Today, you'll meet three women with three very different stories, all of them affected by the attack.
The victim.
My name's Maya. I'm 15 and from Manchester. As soon as the show finished, we heard like a loud bang sound. I thought it was like a balloon or something because there were loads of balloons on the floor. But then I saw all these girls running and like people like passing their children like down the stairs and everything. Like everyone was screaming and I saw someone covered in blood and I was like, what? Like something has gone on. I think he went after young girls because, I don't know, quite vulnerable. I don't know, I think they wanted to like make a point of some sort by like killing innocent children, because a lot of people weren't with their parents, but I was like with my brother. But
these attacks are designed to drive a wedge through communities. They aim to create fear and hatred. In the month after the attack, 224 anti-Muslim hate crimes were reported. That's a 500% increase on the same period last year.
Sometimes, like, these people, they look at me like, oh yeah, you're Muslim, you must be like a terrorist or something. But I was like, no, I was a victim of the attack. I'm not them. Like, they attacked me and they say that I'm the same religion. Like,
after the bombing, the spotlight turned almost immediately to the Muslim population, in particular, the Libyans. During the Arab Spring in 2011, thousands of young British Libyans went off to fight and overthrow Gaddafi. We know some became radicalized, and we know some were determined to bring the bloody violence back home to Britain. When attacks happen here in the UK, security services need to act fast to arrest and detain suspects.
The suspect.
My name is Iman, and I've lived in the UK for over 12 years. I am a student. It was just a normal day, really. Nothing felt as if, you know, something was going to happen or anything. Everything was just the way it normally is.
It's Sunday, 28th of May, 6 days after the attack. Security services are conducting counter-terrorism raids across the Manchester region. Iman is at home alone.
Out of nowhere, all of a sudden, I just hear a massive bang. I look down the stairs and I can just see people just storming into the house, just loads of people.
Iman is terrified. She has never told her story until now.
Just the way they looked, and like they had masks on and some of them had glasses on as well, so you couldn't even see their eyes. And they were all shouting at the same time, get on the floor, get on the floor. Their guns point at me, like, put your hands out, like, keep your hands out, like, still shouting at me.
The security services desperately want to know if Salman Abedi acted alone or was part of a wider network.
He didn't have a uniform on or anything. He was just dressed like normally. And he asked for my name and my date of birth. And he told me I was under arrest for being a suspected terrorist.
Iman had gone to the same college as Salman Abedi, but she says she had no contact with him.
I didn't understand why I was connected to it, because even if we were at the same college, but there was a lot of people at that college. He went to uni. You're not going to raid everyone's house who's gone to that college or, you know, in his class. Or I, even though we were in the same class, but I still didn't see that as being a connection. The only thing that I actually felt is just the fact that we're Libyan.
Of the 22 people arrested in these raids across Manchester, not a single person was charged. The British government wants Muslims to play a bigger role in monitoring extremism. And to do that, it means building more confidence and trust with local communities. It means also looking at the root causes, like the ideology that underpins groups like ISIS when they preach and recruit. And that probably means talking about Saudi Arabia. A recent report from the conservative think tank, the Henry Jackson Society, says that since the 1960s, the Saudis have sponsored a multi-million dollar effort to export Wahhabism across the Islamic world. That includes Muslim communities in the West. Wahhabism is a strict, overtly conservative interpretation of the faith. The Henry Jackson Society says that in the UK, that Saudi money has built mosques and schools, and some have played host to extremist preachers and the distribution of extremist literature. So, what does this all mean in reality? Well, on the streets of Manchester, it's the presence of an increasingly conservative version of Islam.
The leader.
Amina Lone is a politician on the local council. She's a Muslim, and she's prepared to say what many others won't, that this type of conservatism could be connected to terrorism.
There is a rise of fundamentalism across the globe, and actually if we want to say that these people are misrepresenting our faith, then we've got to show that our faith isn't what these people claim to be, which is a very black and white, very politicized Islam. It is not the faith that me and millions of others practice.
Today, Amina is taking me to one of the local mosques. The local imam tells us that women are welcome here. But the reality is, there is no designated prayer space for women here, and they cannot pray with the men.
A significant majority of mosques in this country don't have space for women. I mean, how is that acceptable? So as a woman, I can go and walk in the church and feel quite comfortable, but in a mosque, there may not be space. And I've inquired at a local mosque where there's not space for me to go because there's no space for women. Or I go to a mosque and I'm told to go to the back entrance or the side entrance. We wouldn't accept this in any other institution in our society, that somehow we accept this. That's how things ferment. That's how extremism takes root. And that's a real challenge for a secular, progressive democracy.
Three stories from three women, all in some way affected by this tragedy. What's evident here in Manchester is that this attack has raised a series of questions, and the community is grappling with them, slowly but surely. The British government says it wants Muslim communities to do more to tackle terrorism, but it remains silent on Saudi money and the fundamentalism it exports here. Local Muslims say they want to engage in difficult debates with the broader community about radicalisation. But it's obvious too that they're struggling to confront questions over who defines their own faith and how. And in Manchester, what I've found is a city clearly struggling to find solutions on this question of radicalisation and extremism. But very clearly, a city united in grief and in spirit.
Come on, sing up! He knows it's too late.
A crowd breaks into an impromptu rendition of the Oasis song, Don't Look Back in Anger, after a minute's silence for the victims. It's another poignant symbol of Manchester's cohesion and resilience in the face of tragedy.
Manchester band Oasis ending that special report by Hamish McDonald. And you can hear a longer version on the Religion and Ethics Report's homepage, and also watch Foreign Correspondence Report titled Manchester United anytime on iView. That's about it for this program, but before I go, there's a celebration coming. One of our sister programs, The Spirit of Things, is marking 20 years with a new monthly series called 2020. You can join my colleague Rachel Conn on RN as she traces two decades of tumultuous change. That includes a search for an authentic Australian spirituality. And do you remember Y2K and the apocalypse? Well then, if you do, you might be intrigued by the lead up to the year 2000 when people were running for cover. The series starts this Sunday on RN, July 30th at 6 p.m. Download our interviews from our homepage at the RN website if you'd like to share them or to hear them again. And thanks this week to Nadiat El-Ghorli and Luke Purse. I'm Noel Debien. Andrew West is back next week.